This is Pacifica Radio's Letters on Politics. On today's show...
And I think the story of the Black labor movement is an example of that. Like, we don't all have to agree all the time. We can fight, and those fights can lead to tactical innovation. But the key is that, you know, if we're going to be together on this, we need to have those conversations and at some point perhaps agree to disagree and be united in a common strategy. That is what the Black labor movement did. And I think that is what whatever new mass movement comes out of this moment must do in order to succeed.
A conversation on the Black labor movement of the 20th century and how two competing factions, the African Blood Brotherhood and the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, both that sprung out of the socialist movement, worked together to integrate labor. Our guest is Cedric De Leon. He is the author of the book Freedom Train, Black Politics, and the Story of Interracial Labor Solidarity. That's next on Letters on Politics. But first, the news.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Christina Onnested. Israeli airstrikes in Gaza's Shajaya neighborhood have killed 30 Palestinians, including 8 children, in a series of powerful blasts today, according to Wafa News Agency. Strikes elsewhere in Gaza also left 80 others missing. Doctors Without Borders says strikes hit close to its clinic in the safe zone of Malwasi. Meanwhile, Gaza officials now say the southern city of Rafah has been wiped off the map as Israel's ramped-up military campaign seeks to turn Rafah into what it calls a buffer zone, according to the Israeli publication Haaretz. Decimating entire cities like Rafah could be a precursor to ethnically cleansing Palestinians from Gaza. President Donald Trump and Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu spoke favorably of giving Palestinians the option to leave Gaza during a meeting at the White House Monday. Rafah, which borders Egypt, is more than 3,000 years old and was home to some 200,000 Palestinians before Hamas's attack and Israel's ensuing war 18 months ago. The European Union's 27 member states passed retaliatory tariffs on the U.S. today in response to President Donald Trump's 25% tariffs on imported steel and aluminum. The 25% tariffs on $23 billion worth of U.S. goods will go into effect in stages, some starting next week, April 15th, then others on May 15th and December 1st. While the full list hasn't been released, media reports say it includes motorcycles, poultry, fruit products, juice, and soy. Meanwhile, China announced it will raise tariffs on American goods 84% after President Donald Trump imposed a 104% levy on Chinese goods. Canada's responded with a 25% tariff on auto imports from the U.S. That does not comply with a 2020 U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement that President Trump helped broker. Stocks dipped around the world as President Trump's new tariffs went into effect midnight today. In a speech Tuesday night, Trump said next he plans tariffs on pharmaceuticals, then mocked countries seeking to negotiate new trade deals.
I'm telling you, these countries are calling us up, kissing my ass. They are dying to make a deal. Please, please, sir, make a deal. I'll do anything, sir.
President Donald Trump. The administration has reversed sweeping cuts to the World Food Program, but's maintaining them in Afghanistan and Yemen, two of the world's poorest and most war-ravaged countries, according to officials. This comes one day after announcing USAID was cutting funding to the world's largest emergency food program in 14 nations. The U.S. is the largest funder of the World Food Program. Funding's been restored for programs in Somalia, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Ecuador, and Iraq. According to USAID officials, the status of funding for six other unidentified countries is not immediately clear. Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro has declared a state of economic emergency and granted himself special powers for 60 days to implement extraordinary economic measures. Citing what he described as a commercial and economic war led by the U.S., Maduro said the global situation, including new tariffs on Venezuelan oil exports, is creating unprecedented risks for his economy. The decree allows the government to suspend taxes, redirect public funds, authorize off-budget spending, and impose controls aimed at boosting domestic production and attracting foreign investment. Students rallied across the country as part of a national day of action against devastating cuts to research, health, and higher education. Catherine Carley has more.
Labor unions rallied in more than 50 cities against proposed cuts to higher education and a crackdown on international students. University of Massachusetts Boston lecturer Joe Ramsey says it's tough to teach students when they're afraid to speak their minds.
The injury being done to our most vulnerable international immigrant students and workers right now is an injury to all of us. Our ability to know the world so that we can change it and engage it meaningfully.
The State Department has so far revoked around 300 student visas, many for students involved in pro-Palestinian and anti-war activities. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
President Trump has signed four executive orders aimed at boosting coal. It allows some older coal-fired power plants to set for retirement to keep producing electricity to meet what Trump says is rising U.S. demand. He also signed a proclamation offering coal-fired power plants a two-year exemption from federal requirements to reduce emissions of toxic chemicals like mercury, arsenic, and benzene. The orders also end an Obama-era moratorium on coal leasing on federal lands, requires federal agencies to rescind policies transitioning the nation away from coal production, and promote coal and coal technology exports instead. Sierra Club Executive Director Ben Jealous blasted the orders, saying coal kills. In the last two decades, nearly 500,000 Americans have died from exposure to coal pollution. Forcing coal plants to stay online will cost Americans more, get more people sick with respiratory and heart conditions, and lead to more premature deaths. Donald Trump's plan is as despicable as it is reckless and ill-conceived. The World Meteorological Organization says March of last month reached another record-breaking heat month. Claire Noyes is spokesperson for the WMO.
2025 is obviously and unfortunately continuing where 2024 left off. March was the warmest March on record for Europe. Globally, it was the second warmest behind March 2024.
Also, record heat recorded in the U.S., Mexico, parts of Asia, and Australia. The burning of fossil fuels are a main contributor to global warming. I'm Christina Onnestad reporting for Pacifica Radio.
Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. In the early part of the 20th century, two factions emerged out of the Socialist Party in Harlem, the African Blood Brotherhood and the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. The African Blood Brotherhood was a militant self-defense organization that was sympathetic to the Communist Party and anti-imperialism efforts. The Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, led by A. Philip Randolph, you could say was more of a traditional union that was trying to find acceptance in the larger labor movement, primarily the American Federation of Labor. Both of these groups were principally led and mostly made up by black workers. They saw each other, both of these groups, as being on the ideologically opposite end of the socialist spectrum. But over time, they would find common ground and work together in order to form a multiracial labor movement in the United States. It was their movement that set the groundwork to have a diverse labor movement, and you can argue, to lead to an incredibly diverse federal workforce today, the same workforce that is under threat. Today, we are going to be in conversation about this history. My guest is Cedric De Leon. Cedric De Leon is professor of sociology and labor studies at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and he is the author of the book Freedom Train, Black Politics, and the Story of Interracial Labor Solidarity. Cedric De Leon, it is my very good pleasure to welcome you to this program.
Thanks for having me, Mitch.
The story you tell here begins in the late 19-teens, right after World War One, or at least around that period of World War One, goes through the late 1960s. What's important to know for basically these 50 years that you cover of the almost the first half of the 20th century?
Yeah, the reason why I begin in the 19-teens is that the sort of modern phase of the struggle to desegregate American unions begins at that point. You can trace all of the kind of like developments, including the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom in 1963, back to that point, right? With the rise of figures like A. Philip Randolph, for example. Of course, the struggle to desegregate American institution precedes that point. And even within the labor movement, that is happening right after the U.S. Civil War. But, you know, if we really want to understand why we have the multiracial labor movement that we have today, then my claim is that you really need to look at that period between 1917 and 1968.
Something that really fascinated me was, if we go to the early years, 1917 and throughout the 1920s, is the importance and how some of this comes out of the socialist movement in this country. Can you talk to me about socialism in America during this period of time?
Yes. 1917 is, of course, famous for another event, which is the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, right? And so it's really kind of around this point when socialism begins to excite mass mobilization in places other than Western Europe and Russia. We can think about it as kind of like, you know, a kind of Arab Spring kind of like phenomenon, where something happens in one country and then it ignites revolutions elsewhere. That's the moment that we're talking about, right? The other thing about that moment is, as the movement spreads and it begins to take up other struggles into its ambit, struggles for racial justice, human rights, anti-colonial struggles, the socialist movement needs to grapple with how their politics, their ideology, their writings fit with these other contexts. And so what is fascinating about this particular story is that, you know, most of the folks who carry the struggle to desegregate the labor movement forward are originally part of the Socialist Party, and in fact, a chapter of the Socialist Party, the Harlem branch of the Socialist Party. And, you know, most of the book is about the struggle between two different factions. Well, those factions actually originate in the Harlem Socialist Party, right? There are those folks who believe, as A. Philip Randolph did, that we can work out our disagreements on the questions of race and the question of Black labor and the role of Black people in, you know, what they believe would be an international working class revolution. Whatever questions we might have, whatever racial tensions we might have, we can work through it in the party. And then there were
so
others.
He's a party. A. Philip Randolph, of course, who is very well remembered in history as a party loyalist.
Yes, that's right. That's right. They, as a matter of fact, the debate within the party was between the so-called right and left wing of the Socialist Party, as indeed it was, you know, in other parts of the world, right?
As it always is.
As it always is. I mean, in Italy, Antonio Gramsci, who was the general secretary of the Communist Party there, was part of the left wing of the Socialist Party, and then they broke away and formed the Communist Party. The same thing happened in Harlem. Hmm. So the left wing of the Harlem Socialist Party broke away to form and be part of the international communist movement. And those would then become the kind of left wing of the struggle to desegregate the American labor movement.
There are two groups that come out during this time that's associated with this context that you're explaining. Two brotherhoods, the African Blood Brotherhood and the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. These are both two very fascinating organizations. Tell me about them and how they, I mean, do they split from each other? Is that one way of looking at them?
The split really happens, as I say, within the Socialist Party. And then from that point forward, they then proceed to found these two brotherhoods. So that the centrist faction of Black Labor, led by A. Philip Randolph, basically forms out of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. And that group of people wanted to organize two groups, let's say. One is to organize porters and maids within the Pullman sleeping car company, and to gain recognition and to bargain with the boss of their own workplace. And the other struggle was actually within the American Federation of Labor. Okay, so much of what Randolph does and what the leading stewards of the union wanted to do was to essentially become affiliated with the American Federation of Labor, both because of the muscle that brought to labor negotiations. We're an AFL union, and if you mess with us, you mess with the entire House of Labor. But also because of the resources that brought to bear in support of the union. And so
is the AFL at this time open to Black-led unions joining it?
That was the official line, but there were no Black or interracial unions that were affiliated as actual fully bona fide locals. They were called federal unions. It was a way for the AFL to have Black affiliates as well, but they were segregated out into this kind of different category. So you can see why this becomes the centrist faction of the Black labor movement, right? This is a group of people who are organizing the workplace, right? It's unionism, pure and simple. And what they want to do is become an official affiliate of the American Federation of Labor. By contrast, Cyril Briggs and his comrades formed the African Blood Brotherhood. And this is it's an interesting organization because it mixes Black anti-colonial politics with a sympathy for the international communist movement. And while they also organize workers in concert with communists in New York City, in West Virginia, and other places, the African Blood Brotherhood is probably best known for Black self-defense. So a militant, violent self-defense. And probably the most famous instance of that is the Tulsa race riots of the 1920s. That's really when the African Blood Brotherhood became very well known. And
Tulsa was known as sort of the Black Wall Street at the time.
That's right. So what happens in the Tulsa race riots is that white folks essentially burn down the kind of like center of wealth of the African American community in Oklahoma, which is called Black Wall Street. And the people who defend those businesses and Black civil society against that white led riot were the African Blood Brotherhood. It was the Tulsa Post of the ABP. I'm not sure if that's enough, but that's just a very quick description of like what these organizations were, what they did, what they were known for.
And the African Blood Brotherhood, they have a real impact in Tulsa. They're successful up to a point when I guess what is some kind of military force steps in.
Yes, the one thing to know about that struggle is that the Tulsa Post of the ABB consists not just of Black working class people, but also veterans of the First World War. So these are trained soldiers, whereas the white mob were kind of a hodgepodge of people, some trained and some not trained. And so because of their military training, they were actually able to hold off the white mob and were in fact you know, in a position to throw them back and succeed in defending Black Wall Street. But what ends up happening is that the white forces are able to get planes to drop incendiary bombs on the black part of town. And so that's part of the reason why it burns up. It's because they're dropping fire from the sky. And that's how Black Wall Street is destroyed. So yes, I mean, they're successful on the ground up until that point. But I think that their defense of Black Wall Street in the Tulsa riot lends them a certain amount of street credibility in other parts of the country. So that then the African Blood Brotherhood kind of, you know, becomes extraordinarily popular. They have this very complicated set of rituals to induct people into the Brotherhood, because up until that point, they had been more or less an underground organization, like an organization of black people to defend themselves is not something that you can say out in public,
right.
At the time of lynching and so forth. But they become, you know, an above ground organization after their defense of the Tulsa black community. And they have to simplify their induction ritual, because there are thousands and thousands of black people who want to join the Brotherhood at that point. It's also at that point that the Communist Party sees the African Blood Brotherhood as a potential ambassador of the party to the black working class. And that's kind of like when the partnership becomes, well, it deepens, I would say, at that
point. Does the Soviet Union get involved?
The Soviet Union is involved in the sense that several members of the African Blood Brotherhood and of the Workers' Party in Harlem, that's what the Communist Party was called in Harlem, were members of international bodies that were meant to organize what we today would call the Global South. And so those cadres would go off to these major conferences in continental Africa and so forth, and then come back to the United States. And that's where the encounter between Soviets and African Americans took place, is in those kinds of conferences in which they're trying to plan out what the revolution looks like in other parts of the world.
So the popularity of the African Blood Brotherhood spreads after people learn about its defense of Tulsa. What would end up happening to African Blood Brotherhood? How long would it last? I mean, this is, we've done recent shows about the first Red Scare and then the second Red Scare. Was African Blood Brotherhood tolerated? What would happen to it?
They would become absorbed into the Workers' Party, and eventually, whereas I think the Communist Party was a much more open space in the late teens and early 20s, they begin to really impose party discipline in such a way that they essentially tell the leaders of the African Blood Brotherhood that they need to disband and join other efforts to organize black workers and sharecroppers into the movement. And so there are various efforts such as the American Negro Labor Congress, right? That the former members and leaders of the African Blood Brotherhood end up leading and participating in the overall objective to basically grow the communist movement among black working people. So that's what happens to the ABB. They kind of get absorbed into the party.
The Workers' Party, does this create a multi-ethnic sort of front party, the Workers' Party?
It does. But what is interesting about that is, you know, so much of the story of interracial labor solidarity that is told in sort of the historiography, the social sciences, and so forth, is that, you know, the kind of multiracialization of of the labor movement, of working class struggles, is the result primarily of the efforts of white radicals, for example, in the Communist Party, in the Congress of Industrial Organizations, the CIO, which we haven't talked about yet. What is interesting about this moment is that really the Workers' Party takes from the African Blood Brotherhood its program for Black workers, right? So there, I mean, I don't want to go into to great detail, but the Workers' Party is very and the communist movement in general is quite naive about the condition of Black workers, the extent to which they were repressed, that they were surveilled, that they were murdered on a regular basis, you know, and so, you know, they would say, you know, a number, they would put on their sort of party platform a number of outlandish things that would, black people would look upon and say, are you kidding me? Like, these people do not understand our reality, right? And so what I want to say about this point, Mitch, is that rather than the communist movement kind of being the lead, taking the lead in organizing, framing, and theorizing Black working class struggle, the communist movement actually takes the lead from Black workers, right? It's the ABB's program, and it's their analysis of what needs to happen in terms of organizing people that they essentially adopt whole cloth and put right into their platform. So anyway, I wanted to kind of point that out because it's an important part of that chapter of the book.
Yeah. And how about, let's go back to the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters and the effort to get within the AFL. How does that go?
It's a long road. The AFL kind of goes back and forth with Randolph about whether to allow them to affiliate as an official international union. There are many scandalous attempts on the part of the hotel and employees and restaurant employees union, now known as Unite Here or HERE, to basically steal the porters and kind of like just kind of absorb them into their union. Other unions try to do the same thing. So there's like this endless battle over jurisdiction and who should lead and who should not. But the key issue was that they would be, is that in all of these scenarios that the AFL puts in front of the porters, they would be absorbed into a white-led union and essentially become second-class citizens instead of having their own union with their own leadership and their own rules and so forth. And so they refused to do any of those things. They pushed back on all of these attempts to basically take them over. And after, you know, a period of roughly a decade, at long last, Randolph is able to engineer a situation where the AFL agrees to affiliate. And what they do is they end up, I mean, their solution, which is, you know, classic, right, is they organize the workers. They organize their workers and then create enough power within the workplace that they're able to persuade the employer to sit down and negotiate a contract. And Randolph goes to the AFL and says, listen, I have some good news for you. We have this giant company. We've organized several thousand workers and the company has agreed to negotiate. Will you allow us to be an official affiliate of you now? And they say, yeah, sure, no problem. We'll tell these other unions to, you know, go take a walk and we'll make this happen. But it is a long, circuitous struggle. It's super frustrating. And it's something I want to convey in the book, like, you know, that, you know, if white trade unionists and workers were really the vanguard of interracial labor solidarity, presumably that wouldn't have been the reaction of the AFL, right? On the contrary, they were super inconsistent, and it was a very long road. And eventually it was the result of the efforts of Black workers themselves that got them the affiliation with the within the House of Labor.
Is that the common narrative, that interracial attempts with were led by unions, by the white leaders of the unions?
Yes, that's right. So there's a, I don't want to get too much into the academic weeds here, but the debate over interracial solidarity is basically an either or debate. Some people argue that that American unions were exclusionary towards Black people. Understandable, that's true. And then there is another group of scholars who argue that American unions have been protective of Black labor. But in either case, the main protagonists of all of these stories are white labor leaders and workers, folks who were enlightened and progressive enough to see that that interracial solidarity would be a benefit to the working class movement as a whole, or an impediment on the conservative side of things. In none of these stories is the role of Black workers or of Black labor leaders more than a kind of passing mention. And historians say this, I mean, there are many historians, famous historians, including David Roediger, for example, who have commented on the fact that, you know, when historians write about labor solidarity, interracial solidarity, you know, Black workers are basically a kind of sideshow instead of the kind of the main protagonist of the story. And so that's one of the things that I wanted to do here. I would say that there are a number of folks who have created a kind of critical scholarship, but you could probably fit all of those books on one small bookcase, right? And none of them, most of those stories about interracial solidarity are very local, right? So Robin D.G. Kelly, for example, wrote a fantastic book called Hammer and Hoe, which is about Alabama communists, primarily in Birmingham, Alabama. And there are a number of other such sort of like local stories, right? But there hasn't really been a book about the ways in which Black people tried to nationalize that struggle and really just topple Jim Crow in the labor movement as a whole. And so that's kind of why I wrote this book, because I just felt like that was the untold story.
Talk to me about the importance then of interracial labor movement, especially in this time. Maybe we can get into sort of the Great Depression as well, the 1930s. Sure. What's the important, I mean, obviously, right? We live in an interracial world. We think everything should be sure. You know, interracial. That's understood. But I want to know what's important about this period of time. Is race being used to undercut labor?
I would certainly, and that is a kind of a well-known ploy of the capitalist class in dividing workers, because obviously if we're divided by race or any other ascriptive category, we're not going to get together. But I think that I would put it slightly differently from the sort of perspective of Black civil society, which is that because Black workers were excluded from, let's say, the mainstream formal labor market, there was a continual crisis of unemployment and underemployment among Black workers. And so desegregating the labor movement became a kind of existential struggle. Either we desegregate the labor movement and gain entry into the formal labor market, or we just stand out here, consigned to these informal sectors of the labor market, domestic labor and so forth, the kind of like, let's say, the equivalent of the gig economy today, right? Mm-hmm. Where we have no access to benefits, to a living wage and so forth. And we might not even have access to jobs, period. Okay. And so that's the real importance here, right? Of the Black labor movement. These were the folks who opened up the doors of the mainstream labor market to Black people, today, as you know, as you suggest, I mean, we're in a moment. We have a multiracial labor movement today, but in this period, hardly any Black workers were, right? And it's really, I would say, I mean, it was certainly, we certainly owe a great debt to the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters and the African Blood Brotherhood for this. But I would highlight another group of people, and you mentioned the Great Depression, and that is the National Negro Congress, which operates between 1936 and 1947. This was the group that that worked both with the Communist Party and the Congress of Industrial Organizations, CIO, to organize hundreds of thousands of Black workers, right? There are sectors of the industry, and it turns out these were sectors that were vital to American capital. We're talking about, you know, where Black workers were disproportionately concentrated. And where the mainstream white labor movement was really unable to make any kind of headway, in part because of the race baiting that you alluded to earlier. So, for example, the 1919 steel strikes were brought down by racial division. And the National Negro Congress works with the CIO to organize sectors such as steel, auto, which are obviously central to the sort of like the regime of capital accumulation in the American economy at that point, right? But also meatpacking and tobacco, which were less central, but which were also sectors in which Black workers predominated. And without the National Negro Congress, the Congress of Industrial Organizations doesn't organize those people. And steel, of course, I mean, steel is the sector. The CIO was very conscious of this fact. Steel makes the American economy run. Even auto, in some ways, is dependent upon steel. There's no way that the auto industry operates without a healthy steel industry. So the CIO was very intent on organizing steel. Without them, if we break steel, then we can organize hundreds of thousands of workers, and we can have power in this new industrial economy. The problem, of course, is that in places like Chicago, Gary, Pittsburgh, and Birmingham, where so much of the steel industry was located, most of those workers were Black. So how are you going to get to them, right? And the National Negro Congress says, we'll organize them. Let us pick Black workers who we know, you know, have some skill and expertise, experience in organizing workers. We'll organize them for you, but let's have an arrangement here. We don't have a ton of money. Will the CIO pay for these workers? And that's the arrangement that they had. And so, you know, they organize in the very brief period where the NNC is cooperating, they organize 85,000 Black steel workers. This is 3 years, you know. They organize 119 steel worker lodges in Chicago and Gary alone, right? They organize the Virginia and later the North Carolina tobacco industry, right? And the NNC is vital in organizing the Ford Motor Company, right? There's a lot, again, going back to the historiography, a lot of people who write about the Ruther brothers, especially Walter Ruther, and how pivotal they were to organizing the auto workers. And of course they were. But as you and I probably know, right, who were the workers in those plants? And how did the Ruther brothers organize them, right? And what we know is that the NNC was absolutely vital to organizing the Ford Motor Company. And you know, when we organized it in 1941, it was in large part because of the efforts of the NNC in this period. So we're talking about, so you know, back to your question, how important were these folks? Well, how important was this activity to actually creating the multiracial labor movement that we have today? I would say absolutely vital. I don't really think that they organized steel and auto or meatpacking or tobacco. without these independent Black labor organizations.
In our time remaining, I want to ask more about A. Philip Randolph and the pressure on the federal government itself. This is sort of in the 30s, and then obviously in the early 40s, there was a threat of a mass march on Washington, more than 20 years before we'd actually get that march on Washington in 63.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, one reason why I think the sort of the centrist and left factions are so important for the story is that Randolph had actually been president of the National Negro Congress. It was an organization where the centrists and left factions actually united. So that moment where we're organizing Steele and Otto, et cetera, right? This is a moment when the left and centrist factions are at peace and working together in a united front against fascism and to organize the American workplace.
Against fascism.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. I mean, that was very, they saw the fight against fascism as a two-front war. There was, of course, Germany, Italy, and Japan, and we're fighting fascism abroad, but we need to fight fascism here at home also. And fascism at home, the way that they talked about it, was really Jim Crow, the segregation of the workplace and public life. So that is how they saw it. And the left and the centrist factions agreed on that, on that way of framing the struggle against fascism. Mm-hmm. But Randolph eventually leaves the National Negro Congress in 1940, in part because he's not a communist himself. As we discussed, he was part of the right wing faction of the Socialist Party. He didn't trust the communists, didn't trust and he didn't really trust the CIO either, quite frankly. When he saw that these organizations were essentially dominating the National Negro Congress in 1940, he resigns as president, and then decides to work to desegregate the defense industry, and creates this new tactic, right, which is a direct action mobilization against the state to extract racial concessions from capital. And that, I would say, is quite a serious shift in tactics, right? From workplace mobilization, working with the CIO, to bring Black people into the industrial workforce, to a public demonstration in the nation's capital where you're creating upward pressure on the federal government, especially the New Deal apparatus, to actually finally represent the wishes of Black workers, right, in this New Deal economy. I think that is kind of a key thing that I would want to highlight, because that's eventually where the centrist faction goes, right? I mean, they're playing nice with an organized labor. That is an important feature of what the centrist faction does in Black civil society. But they're oriented towards the state, and this was kind of like the brilliant stroke, really, of Randolph. Eventually while mass mobilization did, in the workplace was absolutely vital, it kept the struggle in the private sector. And in some ways, quietly exonerated the federal government for involvement in Jim Crow unionism. And so Randolph says, listen, this is not, we're not really moving the needle here. I think we need a mass demonstration in the nation's capital. Eventually, the original movement in 1941 gets called off because Franklin Delano Roosevelt concedes to Randolph. He says, it's not a straightforward thing. It's not like pressure and then Roosevelt caves. there's a lot of back and forth in the book. It's quite dramatic. It takes a while for it to happen. But eventually Roosevelt does cave and writes Executive Order 8802, which desegregates the defense industry and creates kind of a commission, a Fair Employment Practices Commission, to bring employers and unions to account if they run afoul of the desegregation executive order. And it's really, you know, in the eyes of many people, it's the first major action of the federal government to help Black people since Reconstruction, right? So anyway, I think we can stop there. I mean, eventually they do the 1963 March on Washington in 1963, but that's the original March on Washington movement.
We could spend several hours going through each of these. Right. I'm going to make maybe a leap here, and if it's a leap too far, you could let me know. I'm open to hearing that. But I have spent many years, not anymore, but in previous lifetime, covering politics in Washington, D.C., covering Congress, covering the federal government, generally speaking. And I always noticed, and Washington, D.C. is a historically a Black town, though gentrification has sort of changed those numbers in recent years, but historically a Black town. But I was always impressed by just how diverse the federal workforce is, and also the unionized federal workforce, how diverse it is. Large numbers of African Americans involved. Do you see a linkage to that, to this history that you're telling?
Yes, you're right, and the reason why the federal workforce is both unionized and diverse is largely because of the efforts of these organizations, but particularly the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom in August 1963. Hmm. People often forget that this was a struggle for jobs and freedom. it's not just to desegregate public spaces and schools, which is of course an important aspect of the struggle. But the way that it was originally conceived by the Negro American Labor Council, which is the sort of preeminent independent Black labor organization of the 1960s, is as a way of desegregating the workforce. And so, yes, the March on Washington broke the logjam in Congress and was able to exert enough upward pressure to get the Civil Rights Act passed in 1964 and then later the 1965 Voting Rights Act, for sure. All of that is true. But it was originally conceived as a tactic, okay, for the Black labor movement to force the hand of both the federal government and the labor movement simultaneously, okay? And so when Randolph and Dr. King and Roy Wilkins and others see President Kennedy in 1963 after the march, and they bring with them the demands of the marchers, most of those demands are about fair employment and about desegregating the labor movement and the labor market, right? The other thing to remember about this is that the AFL-CIO had already merged by this point. They were very resistant to endorsing the march. And it was really only the old kind of like left-wing CIO unions of the 1930s and 40s that fell in behind the march and supported the march, including, by the way, to their credit, the United Auto Workers and Walter Reuther. But George Meany, who was president of the AFL-CIO at the time, refused to endorse. He had a long kind of uneven relationship with A. Philip Randolph. Well, of course, the march, as we know now, was hugely successful. 250,000 people on the National Mall in Washington It's very clearly pressuring the federal government to pass these landmark pieces of legislation. And where the hell is the labor movement in all of this, right? I mean, the labor movement, the mainstream labor movement, is embarrassed that they were not fully in support of this. And eventually they fall into line. And George Meany says, okay, all right, fine. I will make this happen. And he starts to impose interracial discipline on all of his state affiliates, including those of Alabama and Mississippi, who were, of course, the worst affiliates at excluding Black people from membership and leadership and even presence at meetings, even though there were plenty of Black workers in the South. And so the reason why you have a federal workforce that is unionized and diverse in Washington, D.C., is, in my view, the result of that mass mobilization in 1963, which simultaneously forces the government, forces the hand of the state and of the labor movement to at long last desegregate.
Allow me to get theoretical here.
Sure.
Or you know, if that's a proper way of, I mean, let me just do it. If you were to republish this book, Freedom Train, say 10 years from now, maybe you add a chapter or two, a new foreword, prologue, who knows? Could you see yourself including this very moment in which we see sort of an attempt from the White House to go after the federal workforce, which is a very diverse workforce? Could you see this moment as being part of a larger narrative that you tell in this story?
Yes. I mean, if I were to write, if I were to rewrite this book 10 years from now for a second edition, let's say, I think I would add a second. I mean, I would add another chapter, let's say an epilogue called The United Front. Because I think that there's two sides of the story. On the one side is the story that you're gesturing towards, which is that you have this diverse, unionized workforce that has some, you know, that has some power, a legacy of, you know, of the sort of like golden age of trade unionism in the United States. I mean, still workers still have power, right? And of course, this is an attempt on the part of the present administration to basically undercut and roll back all of the gains of the entire working class in the United States, but in particular, the sectors of the working class that are from communities of color. Okay, that much is true. But I also think there's another side of the story, which is the resistance side of the story. And I think it's starting to take shape now. But I think it needs some direction. And hopefully in 10 years' time, they will have gotten the hint from all of us out here kind of clamoring for some organization, that we need an alternative, coherent, progressive vision for the future. And we need to form a united front. I think there is, in my view, while we all have our respective struggles, we're part of different movements, the environmental movement, the labor movement, the civil rights movement, et cetera. We need to tie those struggles to an overarching strategy, which is to defeat fascism now. Because if we don't do that now, in my view, there is a distinct possibility that all of our movements will have to go underground and then fight back above ground in, you know, in a society that we create because we've overturned the forces of the far right that are now in the ascendant. We have an opportunity right now, okay, because we have the institutional power and resources to form a united front so that we don't have to go underground. If we have to go underground, all of our respective individual agendas basically go down the toilet. And so the chapter that I would hope to write 10 years from now is a chapter about the ways in which all of us together put aside our ideological differences in the way that Black labor did in this book and said, okay, we have this one moment in time. And if we fail, it's a catastrophe. Let's get together. What's our message? What are our benchmarks? What's our timeline? What do we want to accomplish this time, by this time next year, 2 years, 5 years from now, and so forth, right? How much of the workforce are we going to organize? Because we need to build a base, for example. I mean, there are various questions, okay? But I think that that's the chapter I would want to write, because if there's no chapter to write in 10 years along those lines, we're in serious trouble.
To draw inspiration from the Black labor movement of the 20th century, you had fierce divisions within the movement. You had factions. I'm sure there was plenty of animosity, as there always is, but yet they still were able to put some of that to the side in order for a shared vision.
Yes, that's right. Look, you know, I don't know your biography, but I'm getting the drift that, like, you and I have both been involved in social movement spaces in our lifetimes. And, you know, there is this tendency, especially on the left, to say that, you know, racial tensions, gender tensions, et cetera, are distracting, potentially disloyal, and ultimately destructive of the social movements that we're a part of. And I think that actually some productive conversation, debate, and disagreement is useful. It's the only way we actually get over those things, right? And I think the story of the Black labor movement is an example of that. Like, you know, we don't all have to agree all the time. We can fight, and those fights can lead to tactical innovation. But the key is that, you know, if we're going to be together on this, we need to have those conversations, and at some point, perhaps agree to disagree, and be united in a common strategy. That is what the Black labor movement did. And I think that is what whatever new mass movement comes out of this moment must do in order to succeed.
Cedric De Leon has been our guest. Again, Cedric De Leon is a professor of sociology and labor studies at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. He is the author of the book that he has joined us to talk about. It's called Freedom Train, Black Politics, and the Story of Interracial Labor Solidarity. Cedric De Leon, I've enjoyed our conversation very much, and I thank you.
Thanks, Mitch.
That does it for Letters on Politics. The show is produced by Deanna Martinez. Kirsten Thomas is our engineer. If you'd like to hear this or past shows, you could do so by going online and finding our archives at kpfa.org. I'm Mitch Jesrich, and I thank you for listening.
Happy 76th birthday, KPFA. On Tuesday, April 15th, we're marking this milestone with a one-day celebration fundraiser. And you're invited. Tune in for special programming that honors the voices, stories, and movements that have shaped KPFA across generations. Now more than ever, we need community media that tells the truth, challenges power, and lifts up the unheard. KPFA has stood strong for 76 years because of you. our listeners, our supporters, our family. Help us keep the movement on the air. Visit kpfa.org and celebrate 76 years of unapologetic, community-powered radio.
This is 94.1 KPFA and 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, and online everywhere at kpfa.org.